Oxford University. He previously held a chair at Imperial College in London, and he worked mainly in computer science and in particular in domain theory, so it's a theory of partially ordered set from a logical point of view. And more recently, like in the last 10 years, I think, he's been interested in the quantum information flow and in a categorical approach to quantum mechanics. And he wrote this seminal paper on categorical quantum mechanics, which had a lot of follow-up. Some of you may be familiar with the work of Bob Cook, who was a co-author with Samson in the paper. And so today's talk would be about non-locality and contextuality, also from this structural point of view of shift theory. So thanks, Samson.
Thank you very much, Julian. So it's a pleasure to be here back at PI. It's sort of quietly doubled in size since the last time I was here, I think. So it's very impressive and very nice to be back, and nice to have the opportunity to speak in this Foundations seminar. So, I think Julio put it perfectly from my point of view. I'm sort of looking at these well-studied topics of non-locality and contextuality, central topics in quantum foundations from a structural point of view. So I'll try and explain. So I thought, since I guess people are sort of with an interest in quantum foundations and quantum information, rather than sort of saying some generalities about non-locality and contextuality, it may be useful just to begin with some, to emphasize some points of the sort of perspective that's being followed here that may make a comparison with more familiar approaches. Actually, one important point is that what I'm talking about is joint work with Adam Brandenberger, and I'll mention a paper that we have in a moment. So as we'll see, the usual sort of probability tables that one sees in this literature on non-locality arguments and the Bell-type arguments and so on are substantially generalized as a sort of byproduct of this work. So there's some more general notion of measurement cover, as we'll see, which fits naturally into this sheaf theoretic story. And this is general enough to include both the usual kind of probability tables that we see in sort of these Bell-type situations, this non-locality analyses that we have, but also things like Cochin-Specker configurations. So these become literally both particular cases of the same general notion, and everything generalizes smoothly to that setting. And indeed, it includes plenty of other things as well. And this provides a setting for a fully unified account of contextuality and non-locality, in which non-locality appears exactly as a special case. Of course, the idea that the two are related has been around a long time. There was early work by some philosophers of physics, like Hayward and Redhead and Stairs, more recent work quite extensively in the current community, for example, a recent paper by Cabello, Peronio and Winter, I think. But I think the sort of there's a particularly smooth and systematic unification from this point of view. So that's the first thing. Second point is we use the mathematical language of sheaf theory, which is a sort of important theory in contemporary mathematics. I realize this may not be a familiar language, mathematical language, to everyone here. We're not going to use very much of it. But I think it is important and very natural in this situation. In particular, what we'll show is that, in a sense, a very geometrical way of looking at non-locality and contextuality, that they can be characterized precisely in very general circumstances in terms of the existence of obstructions to global sections, which is a very geometric idea that we have partial pieces of information. We would like to glue them all together in a consistent fashion, and there are obstructions that prevent us doing that. So a lot of work in modern mathematics is organized around this kind of issue, and sheaf theory is a powerful language for expressing that. Another point is that sheaf theory fits studies of contextuality very well, because it's exactly about functorial variation over context. One could say, because it's about that, it provides a general logic of contextuality, logic in a broad sense, because contextuality is a general phenomenon. It isn't only something that arises in quantum foundations. It arises in lots of places in computer science, for example. If you're executing a program with a state, then you have a context, which is perhaps the storage cells you've allocated so far, or names, labels for things you've allocated so far, and your behavior will depend on the context that you happen to be in. So actually, there's been work using these kind of tools in computer science over the last couple of decades. And so the fact that we're using this general logic of contextuality opens the possibility of, I think, some interesting links between the study of non-locality and contextuality in quantum foundations and these other fields. And it may also be interesting to contrast with a perspective of generalized probability theories or convex theories that have been widely used in quantum foundations in recent years. There's a slightly different twist to things. Because in fact, we use classical probability theory, which after all is probability distributions, if one sort of abstracts from experimental statistics and so on, is perhaps what one directly encounters. And this is encapsulated mathematically, as we'll see in this distribution functor or monad, in fact. And the contextuality arises from this functorial variation over context. So we have things that look like classical probability distributions, but they vary in a contextual fashion. And carving up the world in this way lets us get at certain elements of structure that are not so apparent from the point of view of some of the other approaches. And as I mentioned, there's a paper where you can find further details about everything I'll be talking about. Okay, so let's begin with a sort of basic, simple-minded scenario for where sort of probability tables and eventually this kind of whole edifice might be taken to arise from. So we have an idealized situation where we have a number of agents or observers or whatever, Alice and Bob and so on, each of whom can perform measurements. They can select one of several possible measurements, and they can observe one of several possible outcomes. So this is the sort of basic story of a lot of quantum information and quantum foundations work. The agents may or may not be spatially distributed or distributed in a space like separated fashion, but we allow for multiple such things. And because we imagine a system being prepared in some state, such experiments being performed repeatedly, we can obtain statistics from this and eventually draw up inferred probabilities. So therefore, we can write down probability tables, as we were mentioning, like this. That's a familiar-looking one that sort of comes up in a version of Bell's theorem, and we'll look at it again later. And what I want to do, just to sort of get going, is to anatomize this very familiar table a bit and to see how there's some very natural mathematical structure that's kind of lying here, which we can make use of. So the first thing is that we have measurement contexts. It's actually almost, it's the most important thing, one might say, which of course index the rows of this table. So these are performable combinations of measurements. And of course, one of the key issues in quantum foundations is that not all combinations of measurements are performable. So in this case, we have these four performable combinations, Alice choosing either A or A prime, Bob choosing either B or B prime. And so we get these four contexts, as we'll call them. So these index the rows of the table. And here we're assuming that each measurement has two possible outcomes that we label as 0 or 1. So before we write probabilities in this table, let's just understand what the cells in the table, the empty cells, as it were, mean. So the matrix entry, say in this row A prime B and column 0, 1, indicates an event, a basic event, where Alice performed measurement A prime and observed outcome 0, and Bob performed measurement B and observed outcome 1. So these events are a level that we will recognize, and then we eventually write the numbers in, and what the numbers along each row of the table are doing are to specify a probability distribution on the events over this particular choice of measurement C. So these are the functions, the mappings from C to O, and these are exactly the kinds of things that we're calling events. So it may seem a little fussy, and the usual generalized probability theories kind of skip over some of this structure, but we recognize this structure of the measurements, the measurement context, the events, and then the assignment of probabilities to events. And that gives us some structure to play with that actually turns out to be quite expressive and allows us indeed to get a structural perspective on these things. So in fact, from these building blocks, we can describe a pre-sheaf of distribution. So this is what will express this we'll have classical probability distributions, but they will vary functorially over contexts. So we fix some set of global set of measurements, total set of measurements X, which may be shared among the different agents in the picture that we were showing earlier, and a some fixed set of outcomes, because it's convenient to assume that all measurements have a common set of outcomes. Now, for each chosen set of measurements, each subset of the total set X, we can define probability distributions on the events over this subset. So the events over a set of measurements are the possible assignments of outcomes, if you like, observations of outcomes for each of the measurements in the set. And then for that set of events, we have the set of probability distributions on them. So that's a perfectly ordinary classical probability distribution, but we have this parameter that we vary in, namely the set of measurements that we're considering. And what this structure allows us to do is to give a notion of restriction as we go from a larger set of measurements to a smaller set. So we get a map that goes in the other direction and restricts probability distributions on the larger set U prime to those on the smaller set U. And this is where we're going to get this pre-sheaf structure from. And we just write this standard restriction notation for these probability distributions.
Over in the corner.
Yes. Would you like me to use that, or I could use this laser pointer? You
that
prefer the hockey stick?
The hockey stick is it?
All right. That is yes.
Well, you were
pointing this
with
hockey
you.
Stick. Yeah. Okay, I'll use the hockey stick.
That's amazing.
Thank you for the suggestion. So here's our restriction operator, and it's defined like this. So what we're saying is that if I had a distribution on the events over the larger set, I can use it to assign probabilities to events over the smaller set by taking for each section S prime for each section S in the smaller set, I sum over the probabilities I assign for all those sections over the larger set, which restrict to give me this given set of outcomes, this given event on the smaller set. Okay. And you can see that this is just expressing the idea of a marginal of a distribution. But in this way that lets us express a functorial notion of restriction. So I've sort of presented this in a condensed form. I presented this in a condensed form. I'll come back to the hockey stick later, but for now, I think I'll... Yes, So we're looking at different sets of measurements.
So that, we're varying. Sets of measurements, things which are incompatible, you choose. Like, is a measurement?
Well, we haven't introduced, we haven't sort of said what our notion of compatibility is yet. At the moment, we're just constructing this mathematical thing which could take any set of measurements.
And so when you talk about distribution over them.
Well, so there's two levels. There's having given a set of measurements, we have the set of events, which are assignment of outcomes to the measurements, and then a probability distribution on that set of events.
Okay.
So I've collapsed them into two just to make it more concise. But really, that those two levels of it is useful to recognize those two levels of structure. And this is the point we make here. The reason it's written like this is it's really composed from two levels of structure. There's this simple bit of structure here where for each set of measurements U, we assign the set of events over U. That's all possible assignments of outcomes to the measurements in U. And that actually forms a sheaf, a very simple sheaf of events. And then we can apply to each given set of events we can apply this probability functor that assigns all possible probability distributions on a set. And this definition of restriction that we've made here is actually itself composed from the usual notion of restriction of a function, a single function, just restricting to a subset of its domain, and then the functorial action of this distributions functor. So I was kind of eliding that because But that's really what's going on.
So to compare to what?
Yes.
To the usual situation.
Right.
In like quantum information or quantum mechanics.
Yes.
So should we think of a fixed state, and this is like the set of probability distributions that one has for a set of measurements?
Well, we haven't quite got there, but we're going to a situation where we'll have what we call a model, which is like fixing a particular state. So it's the action of a particular state on a relative to a given family of observables.
So we are about to do this.
We're about to do that.
And,
yeah.
And another little question, just to make sure that I understood. So when you talk about the section, you mean a choice of outcome for every possible measurement?
A section. Given that we've fixed a set of measurements, a section. Over that context, a local section, as it were, is just assigning an outcome to every measurement in that set. And later we're going to talk about global sections where we try and piece all of this together.
So when you talk here about marginalization, you mean like summing over all the outcomes of the measurement?
Yes, so what we're doing here with this, what the point is we're going from a larger set U prime to a smaller set U. And to marginalize from U prime to U in this setting is, so it's sort of slightly more general than where you have a Cartesian product, because it's any subset relation. So we're looking at all the situations over the larger set which are consistent with what we see in the smaller set, namely that the event in the larger set restricts to the one that we see in the smaller set, and we're summing over all of those. So that's... And the fact is that mathematically this definition falls out from this very simple idea of function restriction, just from this level, together with the functorial action of this distribution functor. So it's kind of as it has to be, but encapsulated in one thing, that's what it does. And you see that it's marginalization. But the point is we see that marginalization is functorial. I haven't written down the functoriality equation, but what it's saying is if I go from U to U prime, and then from U prime to U double prime, these restrictions sort of work in the appropriate way with respect to composition. Okay, now we're going to come to what we call empirical models, which are the key things that we study. And this is, we can be thought of as like when we fix a state with respect to some given family of observables. So this is really where we get back to probability tables and actually some generalized form of probability tables where we have... something much more general than the Bell type of situation. So firstly, this is the point also where we address the question that in a particular situation we do regard only certain combinations of measurements as compatible with each other. And again, this has a natural expression here in terms of the idea of a cover. So given the total set of measurements X that we're concerned with, a cover is just a family of subsets whose union gives you the whole set. And often we would consider a sort of irredundancy condition where there are no inclusion, it's an anti-chain, there are no inclusion relations between the different subsets. But it's just a family of sets which express, so each set is a set of measurements that can be performed together. Each set in this family is a set that can be performed together. And these are the sets that index the rows of a generalized probability table. And they're general in the sense that they include both the usual Bell scenarios and things like Koch and Specker type constructions, for example. If you think of a set of orthogonal triples that may overlap in various ways, such as in a Koch and Specker configuration, that would give us some particular cover where the sets in the cover are the orthogonal triples or orthogonal quadruples or whatever they are. They can intersect in various ways, and you can have some very complicated structure of how they overlap in that sense. On the other hand, the Bell scenario is a very particular and special case of this situation. The case is that we partition the set of, if you think about the sort of tables we were looking at earlier, let's see if I can find it easily. Yeah, here we are. So really what's going on there is that we partition the total set of measurements into some family of subsets, one for each agent. So in this case, we have A and A prime and B prime. And then the compatible sets are all ways of choosing exactly one measurement from each set in the partition. So that's actually a very special case of this general situation. Another way of putting that is that incompatibility in those Bell kinds of situations is a transitive relation, which it certainly isn't in general. Okay, so given this family, this cover, then we can say what a model is. It's just a family of probability distributions, one for each set in the cover. So we're only obliged to give probability distributions for sets of measurements that are compatible, that are in this cover. So remembering what this is, this is exactly a probability distributions on events over the set of measurements C, and we have one of these for each compatible family of measurements. Now, rather than considering arbitrary such families, I mean, to consider such families is, with respect to a cover, is sort of very natural in the language of sheaf theory, and then there's a geometric condition once you have the language of restriction that goes along with that. And that's exactly the condition we're going to apply now, and then observe that it gives us something very standard, very important, and physically motivated in the quantum foundations context. So the geometric condition, using the language of restriction, is that given this family, it should agree on overlaps. So if I take any two of these sets in the cover, okay, so their intersection, any subset of a compatible set will also be compatible. If I can perform all the measurements in a bigger set, I can perform all the measurements in a smaller set. So if I'm given two sets in the cover, their intersection is again a compatible family, and it's a subset of both those sets. So the restriction idea that we saw earlier is meaningful with respect to the set C and C prime and their intersection. So we have two ways of getting to a distribution over the intersection of the two sets, one by starting in the distribution over C and restricting, and one by starting in the distribution over C prime and restricting. And the geometric compatibility condition is that these two should always agree. This is the condition that appears, this is the sort of assumption that appears in the sheaf condition, in fact. Now, the nice thing is, which sort of shows already that this geometric language relates to the things that we expect to see in the, thinking of this in the usual way, is that this geometric condition corresponds exactly to the physical condition of no signaling, which of course is a sort of basic condition of compatibility with special relativity, with causality, since after all the sort of measurements may be done in some space-like separated fashion. So, and just to see this, if we consider some simple case here, like with Alice and Bob as before, so we fix a measurement that Alice does, we look at two different contexts where Bob may make different measurements. They have a common, we have a particular event just involving Alice's measurement, and what compatibility implies is exactly that if I marginalize, if I restrict by marginalization on a joint situation where Alice measures her measurement MA and Bob measures MB to get myself a probability for this event here. And on the other hand, I marginalize in the case where Bob makes his other choice of measurement, I get the same thing. That's exactly what the geometric compatibility condition says, and we can recognize this as exactly saying what no signaling says, namely that the probability for Alice to get a certain outcome for her measurement is the same, whether we marginalize over the possible outcomes for Bob with measurement MB or measurement MB prime. So it's independent of Bob's choice of measurement. Bob's choice of measurement cannot influence Alice's outcome. And in fact, because we have this general situation with families of things and overlaps and so on, this is a more general form of no signaling, but one which it can be verified is satisfied by quantum mechanics with respect to arbitrary families of compatible observables. Okay, so we've related compatibility and no signaling. Now we come to the sort of key notion in sheaf theory, which we want to relate to what's going on here. So we're given one of these empirical models, one of these compatible families of distributions with respect to a cover, and the natural question to ask is, can we glue this family together? Can we find a global section for this family, meaning a distribution defined over the whole set of measurements, which is such that it restricts at each context to give us back the distribution that we saw empirically. So of course this is so just to be clear what we're saying here, something that is a section, an event over the whole set is an assignment of an outcome to every measurement simultaneously, independent of the context. And of course, it restricts down to give us something at each context. So it can be seen, in fact, as a canonical representation of a deterministic hidden variable. So, I mean, you can see that asking for a global section, again, in this geometric language, is exactly capturing the idea of having a joint distribution. So in a line of work going back to that of Fine, actually a very pioneering contribution quite a long time ago. But here we see it again in a very general setting with respect to these arbitrary covers and exactly appearing as this geometric condition. Now, if you think about what this is, as we're saying here, one of these assignments, one of these sections here, can be seen as a deterministic hidden variable. It's specifying a given outcome for every possible measurement altogether. And if we think about what this condition means of restriction again, just this standard global section condition, then we see that exactly what we're doing, if this holds, is to recover the empirical predictions of the model. That's these probabilities given to us by our family here. And then if we expand the sort of definition of restriction by marginalization, we see that we exactly recover those predictions by averaging over the values of these hidden variables. So this provides a way of a sort of geometric and canonical way of talking about the idea of a hidden variable theory. And in fact, because it's deterministic, it's easy to see that it satisfies a sort of Bell factorizability condition. And this subsumes Bell locality. So a global section is, in a canonical form, a deterministic local hidden variable model. And in fact, one can show that in general, any factorizable hidden variable model, and now over any cover, so we're a sort of more general than the sort of Bell type scenarios, and whether it's deterministic or not, so it can be a probabilistic model defines in a canonical way a global section. So global sections are, we can, as it were, replace the usual discussion of hidden variables by this kind of rather intrinsic geometric idea of global sections.
Question, so you said a global section is a deterministic model, but then your theorem says...
Yes, and the theorem says, yeah, I mean, the theorem is a sort of a variation, generalization of the fact that if you have any local hidden variable model, it actually realizes the same thing as one that's given with deterministic. You can make the hidden variables deterministic.
Oh, okay.
It's saying that. Yeah, so one is in principle more general than the other, but actually it isn't if all you care about is the which probabilities they give rise to. Yeah, exactly. So what this says is that the whole sort of hidden variable story is equivalent to the sort of mathematical question of whether the empirical model has a global section. And of course, if we turn it around, what that's saying is that the model is non-local, if we're taking the particular case of a, what we've called a bell-type scenario, more generally contextual for an arbitrary measurement cover, if and only if there is an obstruction to the existence of a global section. So a lot of modern geometry is about finding witnesses, objects of some kind, maybe things in cohomology groups or whatever, which witness the fact that you can't piece information together, that the space is sufficiently kinky or twisted or whatever, that you can't do this kind of gluing. So we have an exact correspondence between the language of non-locality or contextuality and the language of obstructions to the existence of global sections. Okay, so now we can, I mean, in this simple setting, and I'm kind of, in this discussion, I'm just assuming everything is finite, which is in keeping with the sort of usual discussions in the literature. So we can give quite a simple down-to-earth method, computational method, for looking at whether these global sections exist, which generalizes things that are familiar in the usual probability tables. So this is essentially a linear algebraic, or more precisely, linear programming method. We'll see. Time permitting, a fancier way of looking at this later on, but this is very useful. So what we're going to do is to define a system of linear equations where we're such that the solutions of this system exactly correspond to global sections, and therefore correspond exactly to hidden variable realizations, local hidden variable realizations, and also, of course, the non-existence of solutions will tell us that we have a contextual model. And the key element in all this is a simple object that exists in a very intrinsic way for general reasons that we call the incidence matrix. Versions of this in the particular usual sort of bell case have been studied. It's just a matrix of 0 and 1 entries, and it depends only on the measurement cover and the set of outcomes. And in fact, it arises as, so the rows, firstly, of the matrix will be, firstly, we sort of enumerate all the measurement contexts, and for each context, we enumerate the events over that context, the set of events over that particular set of measurements. And we put them all in a row, and those will give us the rows of the matrix. And on the other hand, the columns will be all these global assignments which simultaneously assign an outcome to every measurement globally. So those will be the columns. And then in the ijth entry in the matrix, we'll have a row where we have a section, a local section sitting over a context C, and we'll have a column, which is an assignment to everything, and we'll put a 1 if this global assignment restricts in the context C to give us this local section, and a 0 otherwise. So conceptually, in fact, this is the Boolean matrix representation of the tuple of restriction maps. So mathematically, this is a very natural object. It's just if you take this map and you represent it as a relation with some manipulations I won't go through, you get exactly this matrix. So it's completely independent of probabilities or anything else. It's just expressing the structural relationships between the global assignments and then their restrictions to the particular contexts in the cover. Of course, these things get quite big. In a Bell scenario, so we have n sites, each site has k choices of measurement, and each measurement has l possible outcomes, then the matrix, this incidence matrix, as we call it, will have these sizes. So for example, in the sort of familiar bipartite case, two dichotomic measurements at each site, it's a 16 by 16 matrix. In particular, with some sort of choice of enumeration, it's just something that looks like this. Interesting thing is, it's a 16 by 16 matrix. I mean, it's maybe not so easy to see to the naked eye, but it has rank 9. There's actually a nice general story about this, which we'll mention later on. And in fact, the general, sort of more general statement is that although everything seems to be in powers of 2 here, for an n-partite system of this shape, actually this matrix will always have a rank which is a power of 3. And that's actually a special case of a much more general result, which works for arbitrary measurement covers. Anyway, this simple structural matrix really tells a large part of the story of what's going on. If we have a model, so we have over each context, we have a distribution, so we could lay out context, you know, all the probabilities in one big vector. So we get a vector V from one of these models. And what we're asking for is to solve this equation for X using this incidence matrix M. Now, the matrix is composed of zeros and ones, so it could be, I mean, as long as you have an algebraic structure with a zero and a one, then it makes sense to use it. So actually, one thing I didn't emphasize was that when we look at distributions, of course, we're most interested in probability distributions, but the whole thing can be parameterized to work over any commutative semi-ring. And there are some examples which are of interest, apart from the non-negative reals, which is what probability distributions will come from. We have a normalization condition always, which makes sense in any semi-ring that the total value of the distribution is 1. So if we take non-negative reals, we would get exactly the usual notion of probability distribution. But in fact, there are two other cases, at least, that are also of interest. One is where we take the semi-ring to be the Boolean, so we only have the value 0 and 1, and plus now means logical OR, and times means logical AND, which is very much not a ring, but it is a semi-ring. And the other case is to take the reals, so allow negative values as well, which corresponds to a negative probability. So we'll have a bit of a look at how these come in later. But for now, if you look at what the solution does, it yields weights in our given semi-ring. Let's just think of non-negative reals, things in the unit interval, in fact, for these global assignments. In other words, it yields a distribution in our global assignments on all measurements. And the equations we get from this linear system enforce the constraint that this distribution marginalizes to yield the probabilities of the empirical model. And therefore, solutions of this linear system correspond exactly to global sections, which, as we've seen, correspond exactly to local hidden variable realizations. Okay, so let's just ground this with an example. I mean, a familiar one. Here's that table again. So this could be obtained from a Bell state with judicious choices of equatorial measurements. Appropriate choices of angles between the observables, the spin observables. And what we're interested in here is solutions in the non-negative reals. And this corresponds to solving the linear system subject to the constraint that the variables in the solution are non-negative. So it's actually a linear programming problem. And of course, Bell's theorem is that there is no global section. I mean, that's, in this perspective, the right way of stating that theorem. And we can actually, of course, one can do this systematically, but it's actually very easy to give a direct proof here. If you think about our matrix, so that's giving us our system of linear equations, turns out we only need to look at four rows of the matrix. And we pull out the equations we get from those four rows. Remember, where there were sort of those values appearing in the table we just looked at. So we pulled out those values, and then there's a very easy direct argument that there's no way of solving this over the non-negative reals. Well, we simply add the left-hand sides of the last three equations, which gives us this bunch of things, and we see adding the right-hand side, that has to be 3/8. But since these are non-negative numbers and everything on the left-hand side of the first equation is included in here, then it should be the case that the value of the first equation must be, of the things on the left-hand side of the first equation, must be less than 3/8. And actually, the first equation is telling us that it has to be 1/2. So there's no solution. Okay. Just to illustrate how it can be interesting to look at other cases than probabilities, and in a sense to get stronger results in other cases, we can consider the well-known model or paradox, as it's often called, due to Lucien. And here we're considering the possibilistic version, essentially taking the support of what one would usually write down as the probability table for the state with the given observables that we would have in that construction. So from our point of view, all that counts is this data, where you have a 1 if this event is in the support and a 0 if it isn't. And what we're doing is to think that we're working over distributions over the Booleans. If you think about what a distribution over the Booleans is, it's specifying a finite subset of events. So a non-empty finite subset. Okay, so now we're interested in solutions over the Boolean semi-ring, and this is just a Boolean satisfiability problem. So the equation specified, for example, by the first row of this matrix would just be a disjunction. It's a sum which turns in the Boolean semi-ring into a disjunction of the variables that are picked out with ones in the column in that row of the matrix. And on the other hand, where we're setting something to be equal to 0, we're saying that the disjunction of the variables which are picked up is false, which is saying that we're asserting the conjunction of the negations of those things, just by Boolean algebra. So what we're doing is to give a bunch of formulas and ask for a solution is to ask for a satisfying assignment that makes all of these formulas true. And again, it's sufficient to pick out four formulas from four rows of the matrix. So the one which had a the salient feature of this table is that we had a 1 for us is that we had a 1 in the top left corner and 3 zeros, and it's those rows that we pick out. And if we pick out those rows, we get these formulas, and what we're asking is an assignment to the variables which makes all of these formulas true. That's what this quest for a global section leads to in this case. And you can see that that can't happen, because every variable appearing positively in the first row appears as a negative conjunct in one of the other rows. So nothing can make this collection of formulas, no assignment can make this collection of formulas all true. There's no satisfying assignment. Now, in fact, Boolean obstructions when we work over this Boolean semi-ring, are stronger than probabilistic ones, simply because, we have this descent result that says if you have a solution over the non-negative reals, it descends to a solution over the Booleans, where you have the obvious map that replaces any positive real by 1 and leaves 0 fixed. And the reason that works is simply because this is a semi-ring homomorphism. So there's a semi-ring homomorphism from the non-negative reals to the Booleans. By the way, there's no semi-ring homomorphism from the reals to the Booleans. That just doesn't work. And if you start thinking about negatives, you very easily see why. So that's a sense in which which is why you can do more things with negative probabilities than you can with either of these cases.
Can you provide us the exact definition of semi-ring?
Yes, it's so you have two monoids, addition, commutative monoids, addition and multiplication. So you're not assuming negatives, but you're assuming that you have associative commutative operations with unit elements. And so one you call plus and one you call times. And the final thing is that times should distribute over plus in the usual sense. So it's everything that you would have in a ring, except that you're not saying that you have negatives for addition. Just like you go from groups to sort of semigroups or monoids. So some people prefer to call them rigs, because because you've taken out the negatives. So, but anyway, I'm used to calling them semi-rigs. So please bear with me. So all right. So if we turn this little observation around, it tells us that non-existence of solutions over the Booleans implies non-existence of solutions over the non-negative reals. So, and actually, we see a difference between the two examples we've just looked at. As we saw with Bell, there's no solution with probabilities over the non-negative reals. But actually, it's easy to see that there is a solution over the Booleans. If we just go to the support, then we can perfectly well find a global section. But with Hardy, there's no solution over the Booleans, and therefore a fortiori, no solution over the non-negative reals. So in that sense, Hardy exhibits a stronger form of non-locality or contextuality than Bell. That can't be bad, can it, Lucy? See, I'm giving you good publicity here. So, okay. So that was two versions. So the Booleans can be thought of as a sort of useful abstraction of probabilities. You get some information, of course, you don't keep perfect information, you must lose something. The really interesting, a wilder possibility is to consider negative probabilities. And some great names have sort of been quite interested in the idea and discussed the idea of negative probabilities, that somehow quantum mechanics leads one to contemplate these things. So here's a quote from Feynman. The only difference between the probabilistic classical world and the equations of the quantum world, somehow or other it appears that probabilities would have to go negative. Of course, one answer to that is you go to amplitudes and eventually you recover the usual kinds of probabilities. But he certainly was considered that. So did Dirac in a different way and Wigner perhaps, most things, and other people as well. So one might hope that allowing negative probability signed measures, as measure theorists call these things, might be a way of capturing the quantum realm. And in fact, our result here says that this doesn't happen, and that you really, if you allow negative probabilities, you capture all the quantum things, but actually you capture more. In fact, there's an exact correspondence between allowing negative probabilities and the going to the whole class of no signaling models, which includes, of course, superquantum things. So in other words, a probabilistic model has a local hidden variable realization, where we should put quotes around that, with negative probabilities, exactly if and only if they satisfy no signaling. And that's with respect to these arbitrary measurement covers. So the negative probabilities characterize no signaling rather than the quantum realm. And this falls out from a result that, there have been some results for sort of Bell situations in this direction, but this is, I think, rather more general because it applies to arbitrary measurement covers. And it actually tells us quite a lot about the structure of the incidence matrix and the things we've been looking at. So the point is, when you go to negative probabilities, you're no longer looking at the convex polyhedron convex cone of probabilistic models, you're looking at the whole linear subspace that's generated by the local models or the no signaling models. So you're closing up under arbitrary linear combinations, not just non-negative ones or convex ones. And the result is that these two subspaces coincide. So you get the same when you close up with arbitrary linear combinations. Whether you start, of course, the local models sit in there as a very much a subset of the no-signaling ones. They're much smaller. But once you close up under arbitrary linear combinations, you get exactly the same things. And this is shown by a dimensional argument, which which also tells us the rank of the incidence matrix in general. And this is a general formula for an arbitrary measurement cover for the dimension of the two. So what one does is one shows on the one hand that there's an upper bound for the dimension of the space of linear space of generated by the no signaling models, and a matching lower bound for the dimension of the linear space generated by the local models. And that is given by this value. And this shows, incidentally, that although we focused on these maximal sets of compatible measurements, those are the things we generally take to be in the cover, a very natural role is also played by all the subsets as well. After all, those are the places where you marginalize, and geometrically, this is the simplicial complex generated by these faces, which would be the maximal compatible sets. So we need those to count the dimension. Okay, so that's what we just said. And as a special case, in these NKL Bell scenarios, we can derive from this formula by some analysis and some use of the binomial theorem, this one. But also, we can apply this directly to a lot of other cases. So the well-known 18-vector Cochin-Specker construction, we can characterize the dimension of the space there, and therefore the rank of the incidence matrix, and for things like Peres-Mermin square and so on. So this seems to be a useful thing. As a small example, I mean, we're saying that all no-signaling boxes have local hidden variable realizations with negative probabilities. So here's the most famous no-signaling but super-quantum device, the PR box, or the simplest version of the PR box. So no quantum system can realize this. Here is a probability distribution on the global assignments of outcomes to measurements, which does realize it. And, well, you can actually run it through your favorite linear equation solver, because we're just solving a system of linear equations. Okay. So, how much time do I have left at this point?
It's 10 minutes.
10 minutes, okay. Right, so I won't say everything, but that's fine. So I do want to say something about this next notion of strong contextuality. So we've looked at the sort of basic idea of, you know, non-locality generalized to contextuality in this setting. And I want to look at a stronger property, which seems to come up in many different situations, is closely allied to the Cochin-Specker theorem, which gives a kind of generic form of this notion, and is allied to a lot of other things, but can be studied as part of the message of this in a very sort of qualitative or even logical way. This is what we call strong contextuality. So again, we're focusing on the support. So this is the support of the probability distribution. And we're looking at all those global assignments, I mean, for this model E, assignments of outcomes to all possible measurements, which have the property that however you, that each actual compatible set of measurements, each context, the restriction to that context is a possible assignment according to our model. It does live in the support. Now, if this model had a global section, its whole behavior would be covered by these global sections. That was by these global assignments. That was exactly what our definition of global section was saying. The whole behavior would be determined by these things. So in particular, this set would be non-empty. So if we're looking at failures of existence of global sections, in other words, if we're looking at contextuality, or in particular non-locality, what would be the most drastic failure we could have? So we can say that the model is strongly contextual if not only can we not cover the whole behavior with these global assignments, we can't find even a single lousy one global assignment which is consistent with the support of the model. That's what we mean by strong contextuality, if this set is actually empty. So this is certainly something that implies contextuality, and in fact it's strictly stronger. So I was bigging you up before, Lucien, but now I have to say that the Hardy model which is possibilistically non-extendable, has no global section even over the, with respect to the Booleans. However, it's not strongly contextual. One can give a simple example of a global section that does live in the support. Then one might ask, are there models arising from quantum mechanics which are strongly contextual in this sense? And in fact, there's a sort of very well-known and beloved family of models, the GHZ models. For all n-partite systems, for all n greater than 2, and they're all strongly contextual. So these exhibit the strongest form of contextuality. So this part I'll go quickly through. I guess people have seen, are very familiar with GHZ states, but they have these, really all the interesting information with respect to these kind of arguments is in the support of these models. And there's everything is controlled by the four-element cyclic group, which one can understand if you think of a pair of mutually orthogonal equatorial measurements and how the angles combine. And so you get these parity conditions. So in the... I won't try and go through this. And in fact, I won't give this argument. But this is a sort of logical argument, just using some simple properties of from this structure of the support that we gave here, so to speak, logical properties of the support, to show that there can't be a global section. This argument, interestingly, works for all cases greater than 3. The one case it doesn't work, you need to have at least 4 of these Y measurements available in order to make the argument work. So the one case, this argument as it stands, and then it's to do with sort of things being the same and different and transitivity of equality. And so it works very simply, but it does need that much in the model. So the one case it doesn't work for is the most familiar one, the tripartite case, tripartite GHZ state. And it turns out that the well-known paper by Mermin, which talks about instruction sets, very nice exposition on the GHZ state, can exactly be seen as, it took me a long time, I mean, although it's a beautiful paper, it took me a long time to understand what the assumptions, logically what the assumptions were and what the conclusion was, but I mean, what it does exactly show is that there's no global assignment in the tripartite case. And it does this by a certain sort of amount of case analysis. So it doesn't fall out quite by this line of argument, but it proves the same thing. Okay, so that's a qualitative notion. It's just about whether there exist these global sections in the support. But actually, it relates to a quantitative notion which has been studied in the literature, which is the idea of sometimes called maximal or full contextuality. And people talk about, or EPR2 decompositions, people talk about the non-local fractions of models. And essentially the idea is, given a model, how big a part of it can you cover with a local model? So can you write it as a convex combination of a local model and a no-signaling model? And the largest factor you can give to a local model in such a convex decomposition, or the supremum over all such fractions, is defined to be the non-local fraction in the usual Bell case. And of course here this generalizes to what we can call the non-contextual fraction, because we're working over any measurement cover. And in fact, one can show that a model is strongly contextual if and only if it's maximally contextual in this sense.
Yeah, but why don't you say that the Kolpin-Specker itself is strongly non-contextual?
It absolutely is. It's exactly talking about that. The further turn of the screw with Koch and Specker is that it's a generic strong contextuality result, meaning it's independent. Well, the point is, you give a particular, if you like, you give a particular model which you show is strongly contextual, which has the additional property that any quantum state is going to have its support sitting as a subset of the support of this one thing that you've proved, if you set up the observables the right way. And of course, if a larger support doesn't have a global section, then any subset of it will also not. So you're doing a one-for-all proof. So it has that extra twist, but otherwise it's exactly strong contextuality. Yes. And let me even mention, well, all right, so maybe I'm running out of time, but there's actually a sort of biased computational take on this, where you can quantify the amount of contextuality in terms of a natural linear programming problem that you can associate with the setup that we've been looking at. And which it seems to me, well, anyway, so maybe I'll just to finish up, I'll say a little bit on this final topic, which is, and in fact, this is some work with a couple of students of mine, Shane Mansfield and Rui Barbosa, who was just presented at the QPL meeting that just took place a couple of days ago. And here we're trying to make use of this mathematically rich and powerful language. So one of the main things you do with sheaves is to use sheaf cohomology and to show that these tools can be applied to this idea of viewing non-locality and contextuality as it's specifically cohomological obstructions to global sections. So I don't want, I mean, I guess, it's kind of, I don't know how familiar this kind of thing is to everyone. I'm a learner here myself, I guess, but it's, I think, and although this work is in a preliminary stage, I think enough has been done to show that there is something interesting here. So the main thing you need to work with cohomology is you have to have some kind of abelian group structure in order to define the homology, or in this case, cohomology groups. So we start with the support of a model, and then we take the free abelian group generated by the support. So we're arbitrary integer linear combinations of elements of the support, which is not very beautiful. It's the sort of thing that is standardly done in homology, but maybe there's something better. And then there's a very natural fit between the sort of usual idea of check cohomology for sheaves or pre-sheaves and our situation, because that the check cohomology is defined with respect to a cover, and the cover is exactly what we have. In our case, the cover is the sets of compatible measurements. And the idea is that to each section, we associate an element of one of these cohomology groups, a relative cohomology group, which can be seen as a witness, an obstruction in the cohomology to the possibility of extending this partial section, the section that lives just over one context here, to be a global section, to be something that's defined everywhere. So the idea is that the non-vanishing of the obstruction provides a cohomological witness for contextuality and strong contextuality. And we have been able to show that this works for quite a lot of examples, including GHZ, PR boxes, various Koch and Specker constructions, and so on. That's the good news, but there's still a lot to be done. So, and just the sort of modalities here about contextuality and strong contextuality, we want to show, I mean, so to show that the model is non-contextual, we have to show the obstruction vanishes for every section, and to show that it's not strongly contextual, getting it the right way around is confusing, is that it vanishes for some section in the support. If you turn these around, you get the sort of equivalent conditions for characterizing contextuality or strong contextuality. So the weakness, one weakness in what we've done so far is that it works for some things and not for others, and it doesn't provide precise information, so there are false positives. Because you have these integer linear combinations, you can have things that look like global sections, but are kind of fake global sections. So you seem to pass the test, but really you've passed it with a kind of fake global section, so it's not really okay. Fortunately, there's a lot of cases where that doesn't happen. But one case where it does happen is actually the Hardy model that we looked at earlier. And here is a kind of fake global section where you see we've allowed this integer linear combination of sections as one of the members of the family, which is the sort of thing we're allowed to do when we pass just from the set of sections to this free abelian group that it generates, which we can feed into the sort of cohomology machine. And one can check that this works, the sort of compatibility conditions are satisfied. So it does appear to pass the test, even though, of course, really it shouldn't, because there shouldn't be, for a particular section, the one in the top left corner, the non-locality means exactly there is no bona fide way of extending it to a global section. Okay, so that's the bad news. So let's, but there are a lot of, when we go to strong contextuality, there's a large number of cases where this does work. So here is an 18-vector Coach and Specker construction, sort of a fairly well-known thing. So we have, we're working in R4. I mean, if we think of it concretely, we have nine orthogonal bases. We have some overlaps, as you see. To check the necessary compatibility conditions and see if we can actually solve these equations, we end up with these equations. We want to, and the essential point is to show that we can't extend a section globally. We start with one row, which is an honest row where there's just one and everything else is zero. And then we have to see if we can find, I mean, this is what technically what using the relative cohomology lets us do. It lets us focus in one place. But then we have to play the cohomology game and see if there's any way of solving the equations that let us make a family containing this thing. So we have this set of equations, and we have to show that it has no solution in the integers. If you're showing that there's no solution, it suffices to show there's no solution, for example, in the mod 2 integers, so you can do a computation and check it. So we do that computation, or the computer does that computation for us, and it does check out. And, well, there are sort of families where we begin to see some elements of a structure theory here. And there are some families of things where we can say that this obstruction is a complete invariant. In general, the current condition is sufficient but not necessary. But there is a strong feeling from these kind of partial results we've already got. So incidentally, this result can be seen as a generalization of the familiar parity condition that is often used in Coach and Specker arguments. So the fact that in the 18-vector case, the sort of standard argument is that there are nine of these sets, but each particular vector appears in two of them. So if you think about just about the parities, and you're setting one thing in each set of four to be one and the others to be zero, then there's a contradiction by parities in that being possible. So that's a standard form of proof for Coach and Specker configurations. And this is a generalization of it. And then, so we get some family of these covers, and we start to see the sort of structure of these covers and some symmetry properties and so on, where the cohomology condition, as we have it, does work. So the sort of feeling is that if we find the right assumptions, this obstruction becomes a complete invariant. And of course, there's lots of other things we want to do to further develop this and get it going. But I think there's enough there to suggest that there is something fruitful in applying these methods, which, as far as I know, have not been applied in this area before, to go more deeply into understanding the structure of contextuality. And if we think of the difficulties in understanding many party situations, these kind of tools may actually have a useful role to play there. Okay, well, I'll finish up there. I hope this has given a flavor of this kind of work. Let me say that I'm going to be around in the Institute this week, so if anyone would like to have a chat at any point, I'd be delighted to do so. And one of the things I'm sort of interested in as a further direction going on from this is to look from this point of view and with these kind of tools at the project of axiomatization and reconstruction of quantum mechanics that Lucien, Julia and others have been involved in. So that's one thing that, but there are lots of other aspects as well. Okay, well, thanks very much.
We have time for a couple of questions.
So can one use this sort of approach to gain any insight into the power of quantum theory in information processing, such as computing or even more basically the telepathy, what's the name for that? Can you think of situations where you don't have a global section as a kind of resource for communication complexity?
That's an interesting thought. The things that I'm aware of in computation that are close to this are firstly, it's actually quite close to questions that have been studied in databases. If you think about supports here and these different contexts, this is actually surprisingly close to the idea of relational databases, where you have tables that pick out different attributes, and then you're interested in whether you can combine information consistently between different tables. So the database join dependencies are actually kind of gluing conditions. And there are a lot of algorithmic problems that relate to that. So that's one area. And there are also certain things in current developments in logic to do with capturing notions of dependence and independence that this is close to. I'd be interested to learn more about what you had in mind on that point.
Just a quick question. This intriguing result that negative probability models are the same thing as no sibling models. Maybe I wasn't following, but is that true for multipartites or just?
Yes, it's true for, in this general setting, it's true for all the sort of usual NKL things or whatever, all the usual multipartite things, but also for everything we're calling a measurement cover. So it includes all these Koch and Specker kind of situations and so on. So you can have arbitrary families of observables gathered together in compatible families and intersecting however they intersect. So yes, absolutely. And as I say, I mean, structurally or combinatorially, the things that correspond to the usual multipartite situation is a very special case of that. Because, usually you have this idea, usually you never consider more than one measurement at each site in a single compatible family. That's the special thing. That's why I say that, in a sense, in those settings, incompatibility is transitive, which it certainly doesn't need to be in general, of course. So, the short answer is yes. It does include multipartite. So it does include more as well.
So all the examples, I think, that you showed of this cohomological obstructions, those were all what you might call the logical paradoxes.
Well, yes, because the way we're setting this up is that we're not bringing the probabilities into the picture. We're just looking at the support.
But early on, you discussed about probabilities also.
Absolutely, yes.
So do you have hope to get some?
Yes, the right way of mixing the cohomology and the probability is, my first thought, that's one of the many things that are still, this is sort of early at an early stage, but the thought was to get it going at this logical level first and then to weave the probabilities in. The trouble with, you could, after all, since you have this semi-ring structure, you could, try and make things work just there. But then you run into the fact that all this, the underlying algebra that makes cohomology work really relies on having negatives and differences and kernels and co-kernels and all of that kind of stuff. So you need to complete into something that has negation, subtraction. So in some ways, that the fewer coefficients you have, the better. So at least if you get it down to the integers, then, but yes, one should bring in probabilities, of course. Yes. But I would make the point that it is striking how much of the structure of the whole discussion of on-locality and contextuality can be carried out just at this sort of, so to speak, logical level.
My own personal feeling is that's somehow more fundamental than probabilistic arguments anyway.
There are no more questions. I suggest that we thank Samson again, and maybe we continue the discussion informally if someone is interested in it. Okay, so let's make